Hello, and welcome to Four or Fewer, presented by the Brad Pitt Cast.
A new intro for you, Dan.
Yeah.
You love a new intro.
I do. Four or Fewer and its movies.
And it's, don't start complicating things. This is a clean entry for new listeners to the podcast.
I am Dan Dixon.
My name is Joseph Earp. You have to explain what Four or Fewer is.
Four or Fewer is a film in which we...
A film?
A podcast.
Are we going to start again? No.
We got to keep going.
Tight.
We cover the filmographies of directors who have made four films or fewer.
Amazing. And the subject of our first Four or Fewer miniseries?
Lynn Ramsey.
Lynn Ramsey. Scottish filmmaker Lynn Ramsey, who is an all-time great filmmaker, in my opinion.
I've now seen 50% of her filmography.
You're halfway through.
Yeah.
I wanted to do some biographical stuff on Lynn Ramsey.
Please.
Before we talk about the film that we're here to discuss today, which is her debut.
Should we just say, I feel like, say someone, they love Brad Pitt, they look up the Brad Pitt Cast. Here we go, let's listen to the latest episode of the Brad Pitt Cast. We talk about all sorts of movies on this show.
Mm-hmm.
It's oriented by Brad Pitt's films, or has been, and we are doing this as a kind of diversion. But we often do other films, non-Brad Pitt films.
We are, just as Lynn Ramsey is an elliptical filmmaker... We are an elliptical and discursive podcast.
We don't follow the rules.
We don't say it like that, Dan.
Sorry.
You make it sound like we're going to cut ourselves on all that edge. We've done episodes on films like Jason Takes Manhattan, Nixon. We've done what we should have called, but never called, Pit Stops.
Yeah.
We've done films that don't involve Brad Pitt. And now we're going to be doing, for the remaining 16 films of Brad Pitt's filmography,
a rotating
back and forth between the miniseries and four films of Brad Pitt. That's all you need to know.
Yeah,
that's the background.
So
there are things that we're going to do that we do on the Brad Pitt episode. So if you, I know, we need to talk about that as well. Dan, I'm trying to.
Sorry.
I'm imagining a massive Lynn Ramsey fan,
yeah.
And there's not a lot of Lynn Ramsey information out there, and they need to immediately be hooked by us and
nice.
Have like a great time.
Please.
We have to talk about the fact. Oh, she's not very loud anymore.
She's quieted down.
So...
It's hard to know what's being picked up on, Mike.
She's barking again. If you are a long-time listener of the Brad Pitt Cast, you will know that since before the podcast's inception, I had a very beloved greyhound named Ida, who was my whole world. I loved her so much. And she passed away a month and a half ago.
Is that all?
I just had to cancel her RSPCA pet insurance, which, like, being held on, like, the jaunty hold music on the phone when you're calling to be like, my dog's dead.
Yeah, we don't allow for that.
And they read you out, like, this whole long spiel, including, like, just so you understand, your dog will be no longer covered under that. It's, yeah.
Yes.
I know. It's good for her to
unless
not
it covers
covered.
Other planes.
Yeah, exactly. Unless this is heaven insurance, in which case I'm not paying enough. Yeah, heaven insurance shouldn't be that cheap. And when Ida died, I knew I didn't want to get another dog. I didn't want to adopt another dog. But I signed up for a bunch of fostering programs. And early today, I got a text message saying, it's the long Easter weekend. We have a bunch of dogs that need homes. And they sent me a long list of these dogs that needed homes. And there was a fox terrier and her teenage pup. And I thought, oh, fox terriers are beautiful dogs. But a teenage dog, it's maybe a bit too much. I want something really quiet. And one of the dogs they sent was a pug that they said was so elderly, it was possible. So this pug has run away from home and has been collected by the pound and hasn't been claimed yet. So this still counts as a missing dog. But what they explained to me both over the phone and...
If you're missing a pug,
yeah.
Give us a call.
If you're missing the world's oldest and possibly grossest pug, no, we'll get to that. They told me, you know, there's a 14-day mandatory holding period in which the dog still... I know. Dan, I'm trying.
I'm sorry.
In which the dog still belongs to its old owner. But they were saying... Listen, this dog is so unwell. It can't get up. We're having to, like, pick it up and take it outside to go to the bathroom. It's doing nothing. It's not really eating. So it's entirely possible that you'll look after it for these 2 weeks and then tell us you have to put this dog down. That's how much suffering it's possibly been in. And I went and picked it up because I thought, quiet, gentle, near-death door, precisely what I need to get over my beautiful dog, you know, just a very short stay. And Dan was waiting kindly out the front of my house because this all took much longer than expected. We brought the dog in, opened the cage.
The dog speeds out, dragging its hind legs behind it.
It has one paralyzed leg. And for the last, how many hours? Three hours.
About 3 hours.
It has neither stopped running around, farting, making the most hideous noises.
Like snuffling. It's constantly. I know pugs snuffle. This is next level snuffling.
This is really next level. It's. I've never quite seen a creature so far from death's door.
it's resisting it wildly. Wild-eyed enthusiasm for, and it's learned to climb certain steps in the house
immediately
despite its paralyzed leg.
And we shouldn't call it it.
Sorry,
she hasn't had a name yet. Maybe I'll call her Lynn. maybe that would be for Lynn,
the wild-eyed pug.
Exactly. She's just, and anyway, she's downstairs. I assumed the reason why I got this fucking dog was because I assumed that I could just leave her downstairs, have a real chill time. I imagined I would be lifting this dog from place to place when I wanted it to go somewhere. And instead, she is at the bottom of the stairs, barking up the stairs because we're up here.
But the bark is like a hoarse yelp.
I love animals and I love dogs so much. And I say this with kindness and love in my heart. This is a fairly disgusting dog.
It's extremely disgusting.
Just farting, eye mucus everywhere, like rolling her eye mucus on every surface.
Pressing onto you.
Pressing. She's a lovely dog with a real good spirit, and I'm sure next time you hear her, I'll be like, well, guess what? I've adopted Lynn or something crazy. Given how my life goes, I can't predict these things.
I have genuinely never seen such a hyperactive dog in my entire life.
No.
I mean, because she, not once has she paused.
No, she hasn't she hasn't sat down really at all.
No. She'll get somewhere, she'll look at you, she'll run away.
She's barking, she's barking. We will periodically go downstairs and look at
Lynn. We'll make sure she's doing okay.
Dan had never seen the film Ratcatcher before and watched Ratcatcher. We had some nice sushi with Lynn the dog running around going fucking apeshit for the duration of the 90 minutes.
It was totally... It really added some texture to the experience of the film.
I mean, the film...
Also, I think you have to understand the whole time... And the film was great and I enjoyed it and I will talk about it at some point. But entirely soundtracked by very heavy... respiratory activity.
Possibly failure. You pointed out how hard it is to tell what Lynn's desires are.
Yeah.
It's impossible to tell whether this is a dog in extreme distress or having just a wonderful time.
I think mostly she's happy because she wanted to be near us. She wanted to be snuggling.
Yeah.
She just seemed to like pats.
Yeah.
No aggression at all.
No, thank fucking God.
Yeah, imagine that. If you were rolling the dice, given that it wasn't what they said on the tin.
Yeah, it could be worse. Could be way worse. We're not here to talk about Lynn, the world's most disgusting pug. We're here to talk about Lynn Ramsey.
Yeah.
One of the greatest filmmakers. One of the most, I was thinking, and this is definitely something that we're going to talk about. One of the most singular filmmakers. Mm. It's crazy that you have seen now her first film and her last film, and they are sister films in a certain way.
Yeah, it's fascinating, especially given that their subject matter could not be more different.
Mm.
It's really extraordinary how much they resemble one another in feeling, if not in content.
She has these broad areas of interest that I think we'll start accumulating and talking about. And the big one is grief, and I think a subset of grief that we might call trauma.
Yeah, I think even more specifically trauma.
Yeah.
Particularly if you think about You Were Never Really Here.
Yeah.
And which this is film, about death, but is more about trauma.
Yeah. They're both films that start with something kind of sad, though. When we were up here and we sat down to record, I went down just to settle Lynn the pug, and I came down the stairs and jokingly said, like, listen, to be like, shush. And she ran away.
Oh, poor
thing. She ran and sat in the corner. So it's okay. possible that this is a dog with a tough past.
We can imagine that. Well, this is, she couldn't have a better home.
No. Lynn Ramsey is a Scottish filmmaker who studied to be a photographer, first and foremost. And I think you can tell. I think she has the eyes of a photographer.
I was going to ask, actually, when we were watching the film, because I don't quite know what her background is. Like, did she go to film school?
She did. And she studied as a cinematographer in film
school. Oh, that's interesting. So this is an extraordinary, shockingly beautiful film, I think.
Despite being, as you pointed out, a deeply kind of gritty and in some ways unpleasant film.
Yeah, it's not fun.
Although, anyway, we'll get
to it. Maybe it is actually, now I'm thinking about, anyway.
Some people talk about it as a very dour film. I don't find it super dour. It has these flashes of fantasy that are integral to the film.
Mm.
But even the rest of it, there's always a kind of sense of light and love.
Yeah.
She's humane, and that's such an overused word.
For everyone in the film, I think.
Yeah, she cares about everyone. The other key part of Ramsey's story is if you get the Criterion DVD version of Ratcatcher, not yet released on Blu-ray, very sadly, it contains 4 short films she made.
Hmm.
And she made 4 short films before Ratcatcher, and they were all hugely awarded. I think 3 of them won major prizes at the Cannes short film, the short film festival associated with Cannes. And I think it's possible the film Gas Man was nominated for an Oscar. Let me just check that this is true. Gas Man's just this great film set at Christmas in which a young boy goes and meets these... there's like a Christmas party in the village and it's told from the perspective of a young boy. Extremely Ratcatcher. It's obviously like a warm-up for Ratcatcher. And he meets this girl and kind of dances with this girl and he thinks he's doing it kind of on his own accord. And then he sees the girl hugging his father and the short just ends with him walking kind of back home. And saying to his mother, why was she touching my dad like that? Why was she touching my dad like that? And that's enough to make you realize the father has a second family. And the boy has kind of discovered that his father has an entire second family. It's all completely, it's completely understated, but you perfectly understand. No, it wasn't nominated for an Oscar, but it picked up all these awards at Cannes. The other thing I have to quickly check is you asked me how old she was when she made Ratcatcher. Mm. She was 30.
Wow.
She was just 30.
It's extraordinarily accomplished. Not just for someone who is not a mature filmmaker age-wise, but also hasn't made a feature before. Like, it's a real... It does not feel like a debut at all.
It gets talked about as one of the best debuts ever made, and I actually think that's always kind of faint praise when people talk about that. I think it's... I mean, I'm just going to lay my cards on the table early with... maybe Ramsey full stop. Mm. I think each of Ramsey's films would like crack my top 30 of all time.
Yeah.
And Ratcatcher is way up there for me. This is weirdly... I think this film weirdly resembles the work of John Cassavetes in a lot of ways.
Sure.
But one of the ways, just practically in terms of my life, that it resembles Cassavetes is that Ramsey is a difficult filmmaker who touches on violent and unpleasant themes, whose films I find... extremely rewatchable, and more than that, really easy to watch kind of on in the background.
Mm.
So I watch Ratcatcher like basically every 6 months. I just have it playing often and I'll dip in and dip out because she has this almost musical sense of rhythm.
I think that's right. I think there is like it's a you could imagine it as you can imagine lots of parts of it as and this I think kind of relates to probably not that I was aware of it at the time, but her history as a photographer. She is... I'm just sorry, the dog just I am really thrown by the dog.
We could record downstairs, but the breathing...
It'll be overwhelming.
We could try it in a little bit.
Yeah, maybe we'll give the audience a taste of the ambient dog. You could walk into a room in an art gallery and this could be playing as like installation art or video art.
Mm.
And it would make sense. So you'd be like, oh yeah, I'm... This, like, it really resembles that to me. It's kind of very artistically considered, and there is all sorts of meaning operating beyond the just composition and content of the frame. Like, there's just this constant sense of depth beyond what you are being shown, which is really extraordinary, I think.
And Ramsey is really interesting, I think, in terms of dialogue, because she's really... a dialogue second filmmaker.
Yeah.
Sometimes, weirdly, in my memory, I think about something like You Were Never Really Here or Ratcatcher as being silent films, even though people talk in them.
Yeah.
Just the dialogue is so unimportant. No one ever really says anything that communicates anything of much import. If you think about the big moments from You Were Never Really Here, they're all silent.
Yeah.
None of them turn on dialogue.
Yeah, I don't know if silent film makes sense, because I think sound is really important. But I think kind of mute films, in some sense. I think, like, or speechless. Yeah, I think particularly this sense of... This is a super weird comparison, actually, but the thing that comes to mind is Michael Stipe's lyrics for R.E.M., which are just kind of garbage often and don't really mean anything, but kind of create this sense of experience or, like, sense of atmosphere. And that seems to be more or less the purpose of dialogue in Rousey films, is to make these people... seem like people.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there's just a sense in which they're going through the motions and talking as human beings do, but they never... There's no scene in which a character ever really explains what's going on, least alone in Ratcatcher, which is a film about a young boy who basically never talks, really. He has dialogue, but it's never important. He never reveals anything particularly.
He certainly... You wouldn't say the dialogue is, like, more important than gesture or anything. You don't learn more from the dialogue than you do from anything else that he does.
He says, "I love you," at one point. His friend Margaret asks him, "Do you love me?" And he says, "I love you."
Yeah.
And that's about... But you're not even really led to believe that that's entirely true anyway.
Yeah.
So it's never of much import. Do you want to do the four-sentence game with Ratcatcher? It in two, right?
Yeah. What's the protagonist's name?
Jamie?
Again, these things don't seem particularly significant for the film.
One of them dies, not to steal your thunder for the four-sentence game. Ryan. Ryan is the friend who dies. Okay. James is the main character.
So Ryan... I was going to say Ryan drowns, but that's already a sentence. But that's... Well, Ryan drowns when Jamie is there, but Jamie doesn't intervene or get help. He just watches. And the rest of the film, during a garbage strike in Scotland in what seems to be kind of project housing, plays out the trauma that eventuates from the guilt of that event.
That's it.
That's the film.
That's it. There are subplots. There's a subplot with Jamie's father, who is an abusive man. But, I mean, this is what we talk about Ramsay's humanism, I think. Jamie's father hits his mother, is quite violent quite frequently. But Ramsay also has scenes in which he's kind of like a figure, not of violence, but almost like of fun. There's a sequence in which he's completely drunk and he's fallen asleep in front of the couch and all this drool is coming out of his mouth. So he has the propensity to be scary, but he's not always scary.
Yeah, he doesn't exist as a kind of threatening caricature. He exists as a kind of complex man who does terrible things.
But also an heroic thing. He saves this boy Kenny from falling in the lake and becomes like a minor celebrity. And after he hits James's mother... In fact, I think the last sequence you see him in the film is him dancing with James's mother in this, like, quite tender and beautifully shot sequence. Which is not to say that that gets him off the hook, but it says something about Ramsay.
Yeah, I think the film is... It's just that the film is not about that. The film presents those things, and then it's not about them necessarily, or not reducible to them.
It's not really reducible to anything.
Yeah.
I guess you would say trauma. I guess you would say this is about somebody navigating their trauma. But you wouldn't then say this is about someone getting over their trauma.
It's not Freudian.
No, it's not Freudian at all.
It's very, like, the trauma just, plays out quite obviously, but also there's no real catharsis.
No. She does one of the many things that she will repeat in You Were Never Really Here that she does here. Is she gives you basically two endings. The film goes quite strange and elliptical, kind of out of nowhere. It has these pockets where there'll be this fantastical element. And the film ends with James, the main character, maybe just lying in the river, maybe drowning himself in the river. And then it cuts to him and his family walking through a field, moving their stuff.
Yeah.
So it's entirely up to you to decide... Is this the dream of a drowning boy who is trying to imagine a better life for himself and his family? Or is this a flash forward? He's going to get out of the river and survive and then move with his family. There are no answers provided whatsoever. So it's entirely up to you if you want to decide, oh, this is a film about someone eventually getting over their grief, or this is someone about someone who will simply never get over their grief. Yeah, who just repeats
their grief. Yeah. In the end, quite literally.
Yeah, extremely literally. It's also astonishing that she literally cribs from herself a shot that she uses in You Were Never Really
Here. Yeah, one of the most memorable shots from that film.
Yeah.
When Joaquin Phoenix is underwater, and you think drowning.
And exactly the same thing happens here. I think, and I was arguing about this today with my housemate Tristan, who's got a guest on the podcast at some point. He's a film genius. He knows so much about movies. He's despicably young, and he has like so much content in his head. He doesn't love how elliptical Ramsay is, but I think it's one of her strongest traits as a filmmaker, that her movies unfold the way trains of thought unfold.
Yeah.
She'll see something, a character will notice something, and then she'll just follow the associations, like boom, 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 boom. And sometimes those go through kind of dreamlike stuff. Sometimes they return back to the world. She's completely kind of free associative or disassociative. Which isn't
something that happens much in art right now for some reason. And I think that makes Ramsay distinct today, like as a contemporary director particularly. I guess you could say not quite, but there's a way in which the one other director we will almost certainly do for this, Jonathan Glazer, is like that too.
That's true, a little actually. Bit.
And kind of comfortable with the ambiguity of dreamlike states in film. But I feel like really, even I can't think of any novels that do it. I think it happens in the short story a bit, and it happens in poetry, obviously. But for some reason, it's almost as if cinema feels like it has to take itself too seriously. Although, you know, I guess they're always specifically demarcated as dreams, but, like, The Sopranos comes to mind as something that occasionally permits that strangeness.
I think it's because if you do it badly, it's extremely frustrating.
Yeah,
I think
that's true.
I think the ending of both Ratcatcher and You Were Never Really Here could feel like total fucking cop-out.
Yeah, it was, yeah, definitely. I mean,
You Were Never Really Here, spoiler alert, ends with the main character.
Absolutely watch this film. I just want to, like, not just spoiler alert, but you really should watch this film before having this spoiled. But
it's skip an forward, extraordinary. Spoiler alert. I'd skip forward how many seconds? 12.
30.
No, 30, yeah. Joaquin Phoenix pulls out a gun, shoots himself in the head, and then it's revealed. Wow, I mean, possibly not revealed.
Yeah.
It then cuts to a reset of the sequence in a world in which he doesn't, precisely. Ramsay didn't have the ending for You Were Never Really Here when they started shooting, so that was made up on the fly. She wrote that film in like 3 weeks and shot it in like 2 and just made up the ending. That film was shot so fast,
which is especially hilarious for someone who's made, this is her 4th film.
We'll talk about that in a second. I think it's interesting to work out why it is that she fits our criteria, despite being an obviously extremely talented filmmaker.
Who's worked with some serious people as well, right? Like, is not just someone on the edges of Hollywood, has made major films.
I think there's a reason
for that.
We'll get to it in a second. But yeah, that could be, that ending of that film could be such a fucking pain in the ass. It could be a version of it was all a dream kind of ending, which this film could also be too.
Yeah.
And I think some people, the criticism that people make of this film is as being reprehensibly dour and dire. And you could also read this as being a really frustrating ending because it's like, oh, fucking hell, like, okay, the worst possible thing is happening and a really nice thing is happening to make you realize how bad the really bad thing is.
Yeah.
But because she's dreamlike, because she's strange,
impressionistic,
because she follows ideas and never fully fleshes them out, never takes them to their... She's got to be one of the least self-analytical filmmakers out there. She doesn't give you the tools to unpack her films thematically in a very clean and easy way.
But also narratively. Like, there's maybe 4 or 5 scenes in Ratcatcher that could signal the... Oh, boy. The kind of eventuating of a significant plot that unfolds and that the the drama hinges on. And apart from the death at the beginning, they never really come. Like, there's the scene where Jamie lets in some people from the council to the flat while his father is kind of hungover on the couch, and then his father yells at him for having let them in after he lets them go. Like, they were there to kind of inspect the flat. There's the garbage strike that runs through it, which has dramatic significance but never really, like, clicks with the story in any way. There's this girl that he has something like a relationship with, or at least chemistry with, but that is never resolved in any significant way.
You get, I think, these someone gets of... a hat tip resolution in sure. that he watches that she's having some form of sexual activity with a range of boys,
but maybe against her will,
possibly against her will. It's it's again, it's, there's no didacticism in it whatsoever. Yeah. You can believe whatever you want, but it certainly, at the very least, that's what he thinks is going on. And he like snaps with fury. But yeah, these, it's not even entirely fair to call these things subplots, because some of them are resolved in a single sequence.
Exactly. I guess that's what I mean. Is like, you think maybe the, like, the film will hinge on these things, like the film will clarify around these things, and it just never does.
Mm. And then there are these at least two major fantasy sequences. Yeah. One in which James's friend Kenny ties a mouse to a balloon and sends a mouse up into the sky, and we cut to the mouse
in outer space
flying through outer space,
which is so aesthetically at odds with everything else in the film, which is a like working class grey Scottish like tragedy basically. And then suddenly you've got this kind of like synthy piano music, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As this mouse is like hanging on a balloon, the balloon drifts to the moon, and then the mouse hops off and hangs out with a bunch of other mice on the moon.
Yeah.
These aren't cartoon mice, these are like literal mice that are filmed on some moon-like surface.
Yeah. And the extraordinary thing is, a much worse version of this film, made by a much worse filmmaker than Lynn Ramsey, would, I think, shoot that sequence from someone's point of view.
Yeah, exactly. From particularly the child's point of view, and it would be about childhood fantasy. Which you can read it that way if you want, and you can also read the other fantasy that way, but they don't really...
It happens. The mouse does go to the moon.
Yeah, the mouse goes to the moon.
And you're not... I think all it would take for a lesser filmmaker to do was to shoot Jamie's face watching the mouse. But he doesn't. You just follow the mouse. There's no cutaways to either of the children. There's no sense in which they're even aware that this is happening. In fact, I think the more... a very ripe reading of that sequence is that, like...
it's the mouse's point of view.
Yeah. This is...
about this mouse.
Ramsey has just decided, oh yeah, here's a little sequence about a mouse. The other big fantasy adjacent sequence is James explores a house which is in a process of being renovated. And there's just this 2-minute piece of... I don't know, I just always fall back on cliches when I'm overwhelmed, but bravura filmmaking, in which he's looking out at a field of wheat from the bathroom window,
and which surely doesn't exist, right? Or like
impossible to tell. It's where the family end up at the very last bit of the film. So if you want to suggest that is a dream sequence ending, there are the tools for you to maybe begin to say that. And Jamie jumps out of the window, and the camera tightly kind of dollies after him, and then there's just this very brief sequence where he's just dancing around the field,
like rolling in the wheat. It sounds beautiful, looks beautiful,
and there's just one little shot at the end of the sequence of him looking at the camera.
Yeah.
And it's just Barry Jenkins, the director of Moonlight, loves this film.
That makes sense,
and I think you can really tell.
Yeah.
Moonlight follows the same structure, right, of being quote unquote realist through and through. Yeah. And then having these sequences.
The beach sequences.
Exactly. Yeah. Where just something is so heightened, but not in any particular way.
Well, yeah. It's partially because every other time you see this kid, he's against kind of grey concrete. He's in, like, narrow corridors. It's grimy and gritty and dirty. And then all of a sudden he's in this idyllic field of wheat and the sky is blue.
Yeah.
And the colour palette completely shifts. Everything about it shifts. He looks different. Brighter and more alive, more invigorated.
And as you're saying that, can't don't you feel how close the very bad version of that is?
For sure, and it isn't.
Which
that.
Is so on the nose, where it's like, oh yeah, this kid's life sucks. Here's a brief fantasy sequence of how good his life can be. But there's just something.
There's none of that.
No, because she's so understated, because she never overshows her hand. She's never, like, leaning on anything.
Yeah.
It's very brief. She's done. She's as interested as she'll ever be, and then she's moved on.
Yeah. You can... Yeah, the... In the worst version of this, the child returning to the field of wheat would be hitched to some particular narrative beat around things gradually getting worse or better in his actual life, or moving towards some kind of resolvable conclusion, but that just doesn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Unbelievable. One thing I wanted to say is, so I grew up in the United Kingdom.
I've never been.
You've never been?
I've never been to the UK.
Are you fucking kidding me?
No. I've been to Europe a couple times. I've been to America like 5 times. I've never been to the UK. How did I spent 2 hours in Heathrow once.
You've never been to London?
No.
You've never been to my hometown?
I know. I want to.
Shit.
I'm sorry.
Come for a trip with me.
I would love to. I don't think we've ever... The Brad Pitt cast goes to London. I don't think we've ever talked about that for some reason.
No, I don't know why. I was born in North London. North London. And I lived in North London till I was... See, I can't even do the fucking... Do you think I sound British?
I don't think I would say... Like, I don't think I would hear your voice and be like, oh, Joseph sounds British. I think knowing that you come from England... It may, you know, like your voice that matches your voice profile to some extent, but I don't think it's especially distinct. Write in,
yeah, do write in, because
you have some British inflections and some British like idioms I think that you use, but I can't even think of any. But
I was talking to my friend Danny.
Is it radio sometimes? Right, that seems like
radio. Yeah. I was talking to my friend Danny the other day, and I said, oh, of course, I sound so Australian.
Mm.
And Danny was like, you don't sound Australian at all. She was astonished that I would even ever think that.
I don't think you sound British, but I don't think you sound not British.
But do I sound Australian? I love to draw like an Australian.
You sound like, I feel like when I met you, I wasn't like, Joe's not from here.
Yeah. Because you were,
yeah, looking out for that.
Finally tuned.
Yeah,
you were ready to say something if need be. I got told to go back to where I came from after I came to Australia.
Really?
A number of times, as an 11-year-old, I was repeatedly told you should go back to where you came from. Yeah, by children.
Oh, that's horrifying.
Children are fucked up.
Yeah, they are fucked up. As is exemplified by Ratcatcher.
Yeah, and they have a limited understanding of cliches.
That's true.
They don't even know that it's kind of boring and old hat to say you should go back to where you came from.
Yeah.
I grew up in North London and I lived there till I was 11 years old. And for 5-6 years of my time in the UK, so from my birth till I was 6, I lived in quite a rough area of the United Kingdom. And what happened that Ratcatcher touches on quite beautifully is during the Thatcher era, the government, the population was exploding very, very quickly. The government erected these high-rise flats that were designed to house tons and tons of people,
mm-hmm.
with famously very thin walls.
Mm.
And these houses were very badly built and designed and would frequently catch on fire and were just horrible places to live in.
So crazy. It's just so horrifying that someone would do that to their population. I mean, obviously Thatcher is one of the worst people who ever lived.
Truly one of the worst people who ever lived.
Yeah.
Astonishing. I remember when Thatcher died, I was in Australia.
Yeah.
And there were some people saying, you know, you gotta hand it to Maggie Thatcher. You don't. You don't. An evil woman.
Yeah.
And I really don't use that word often. Beat up the people of her own country repeatedly. So this kind
and
of...
And she had all the information to not do that. Like, people being very clear, like, we do not want this to happen to us. A genuinely cruel woman.
I sometimes think, it's so hard to say what's the worst film ever made, because there's lots of shitty films.
Maggie?
Sometimes I think The Iron Lady.
The Iron Lady, that's right.
The Meryl Streep starring film about...
I think I've seen Margaret that.
I think it's the worst film ever made.
I think I saw it on a plane. I have no real memory of it.
Its entire thesis is, you gotta hand it to her. It was hard to be a woman in politics.
That's the worst.
Fucking, the worst element of identity politics is this idea that...
What's the Andre, Eric Andre image macro?
Yeah. Do you think Margaret Thatcher had girl power? Do you think
that she used
some
kind of militia or something? It's very funny. Anyway, yeah.
So in the Thatcher area, there were these houses, these high-rise flats built, and I didn't live in one, but I went to a primary school, a public primary school, where a lot of my friends lived in these houses, and I went and visited my friends and had a very rat catcher experience. And I actually, Ramsay doesn't talk about Rat Catcher or not. It's hard to find out whether this film is particularly autobiographical, but I think one of the things that the film does well is that it has a kind of Lynn the pug is gone. Do you want me to go and have a quick look?
Danger of tipping her off. If she's...
Do you want some water?
Okay, she can be cute. Her tail lightly wagged when I pat her.
She is a cutie.
She's not the grossest dog that ever lived. I take it back. Yeah, and one of the things that I think Ratcatcher achieves is that it has this kind of extraordinary double consciousness where it feels both totally lived in and as though it's set in the present. It's actually set in 1974. But it also feels like someone's recollection of a time. It feels like it has this awareness of that goes beyond just a child's awareness. And I have this super distinct memory of going to my friend Charlotte's 6th birthday party and just having a totally normal time at this party, which was a Spice Girls party, and I was such a fucking dramatic piece of shit kid. I was like plugging my ears, making a big deal of it being a Spice Girls party. I was the only boy invited.
Yeah,
it was for the girls' sake. I had to make it clear.
I was the only boy invited to a fairy party once.
Did you?
I think I dressed up as an elf or something.
Fuck being an elf. Elves suck. You, did you wear, like, a gnome, a red gnome hat? Yeah, fuck that shit. And when I remember... Lynn the pug is completely quiet now.
She's scrabbling.
All I did was give her water.
I guess that's what she needed.
That's embarrassing. Maybe I should cut that out of the podcast. Just spend fucking 40 minutes being like, this is a stupid fucking dog. And then I gave it some water. Oh shit, RSPCA are gonna come to my door. Listen, I love animals. Do I not love animals more than most people?
Anyone I know. You have developed complex philosophical frameworks around how much you love animals.
Exactly, I'm committed. And the Ramsay Ratcatcher feels shot through of this double consciousness of being told from the perspective of a child who doesn't realize the poverty of their life, but there's also that awareness. And similarly, when I think to going to Charlotte's birthday party, I can now recollect I was just a kid, I was having a great time pretending not to like the Spice Girls amidst the worst poverty that I've ever had firsthand subjective access to. Just those flats were completely falling apart, and the people who lived in them were there for no reason other than the fact that they had to be.
Yeah.
There's a really good miniseries starring Christopher Eccleston, a British miniseries called Our Friends from the North.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it. I think I've heard good things about it.
It's all about the construction of those towers, and it's extraordinary. I would highly recommend it.
All right.
BBC, make some good television.
For sure.
As it turns out. Do you have anything you want to say more broadly about Ratcatcher, and then I'll do... We can talk about... why Lynn Ramsay has only made four
Let me think. It's very beautiful. It is. I find maybe I could talk briefly about how I think there's something deep in me that I remember as a child occasionally coming across films on, you know, something's playing on TV and you like stumble across a film and in it some older kids are bullying some younger kids. I think the most recent film I saw in which that takes place is... I think this takes place in It, the recent It. Like
the sequel. That one starts with some homophobic
bullying. Oh, that's right. Bullying. Yeah, that one. Yes, that's a great example.
Wow, but that film tries to do that.
What an insane set of films. Just a real weird... I think they made money too. I think they did okay.
The first one was a box office smash. So crazy.
I watched both of those on a plane, actually. Separate planes. But really? Yeah. But
King does the homophobic thing and he makes it work. But to start your film,
yeah, to like especially a film that is not necessarily tackling the weighty themes of that story in any particular. It's just kind of having fun with a crazy clown.
Yeah. The victim of the homophobic attack is acclaimed French filmmaker Xavier Dolan. Did you know that?
I forgot that, actually. I think I did know that at some point. I just hate... I think I had this overwhelming... I was never bullied that much as a child. You know, obviously, I had my experience of mild bullying. Sometimes slightly physical, but nothing ever significant. Nothing that scarred me permanently. But I think I am just like, where are the adults? Just let some adults come in and put a stop to this.
It gives you anxiety.
It really gives me anxiety. And it's a very specific emotional experience of not wanting to be a part of it and just feeling very, very wounded by it.
And there's quite a lot of bullying in this.
Yeah,
film.
And there is quite a lot of like older kid bullying in general. Just there's a lot of, and this is going to sound... I don't know if this is going to sound fucking snobbish or... I mean this kind of seriously. I don't mean this in kind of a trivial way or... There's so much rudeness in this film.
Mm.
There's so much coarseness. And not in a way of like... people, the lower class people are coarse. A lot of people coming up against coarse... being kind of coarse to one another and coming up in coarse situations that... in which there's a lot of friction and pain.
Mm.
And that obviously is part of the experience of poverty. Like a key part of it. And I think it's handled extraordinarily well because it's never pornographic, but it also does make this film genuinely difficult to watch.
Do you find it?
I take that back. I didn't find this a difficult film to watch. It just... I watched the first part a while ago of I Am Daniel Blake.
Yeah.
That's a difficult film to watch.
That's a really
difficult This is, film. For some reason, not difficult in the way that film is difficult to watch.
I maybe have ethical issues with I Am Daniel Blake sometimes a little bit. I think Ken Loach is a filmmaker. Have you seen his film Cass?
No.
Cass is unbelievable. It's a book that I read as a child, actually. It's called A Kestrel for a Knave. And the film adaptation is about a boy who finds a hawk and like trains this hawk, and it is so fucking grim and so sad, but it has some levity.
Mm-hmm.
So Loach can sometimes make films with levity, but I Am Daniel Blake has no levity. And I know that's a film that feels a sense of urgency and the urgent desire to really explain. Okay, so
it's not just water.
On record, I'm not a bad dog parent. There are other needs that are currently not being met by us being
up here. Well,
She just wants us down there.
Yeah, she does.
Which is a problem because I sleep upstairs, and there's no fucking way she's going to sleep in here with me. She's farting every 12
snoring
seconds.
Constantly. It's not, the worst snoring.
Yeah. I Am Daniel Blake believes itself very strongly to have a social purpose.
Yeah.
And I'm sometimes... I think those films can be important.
It's not you don't want a PSA when you go to the cinema.
No. I've quoted this before, and I think it's something that explains Lynn Ramsey's films too. Claire Denis was at a Q&A session, the incredible French filmmaker, and she was asked why the African-American character is the first to die in High Life.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, listen, I'm not a fucking social worker. And I mean, obviously, the films that I watch are reprehensible in all kinds of ways, so it's obviously the case that I think that that's how you should make art.
Sure.
But I think Lynn Ramsey, right, has no purpose. And I think she would... Ratcatcher would be a worse film if it had this very precise purpose.
Yeah, it's... there's interesting... Like, in a different version of this film, the TV sequences would be much more like the sequences with the TV that kind of keep you like they do some garbage strike stuff, or there's just like a cartoon, or there's football. You
can imagine Tom Jones.
Yeah, the Tom watch New Pussycat. You can imagine those sequences being used to kind of play out explicitly the politics, as happens in Killing Them Softly.
Yeah,
for a different set of reasons.
Yeah, but the TV as point of comparison. Yeah,
exactly, but it's never really used that way.
No, because she's not making a film about the causes of poverty or even really anything specific about poverty at all.
She's making a film about an experience.
Yeah, this precise experience.
Yeah, it's very particular.
And all of her films have that extreme specificity.
Yeah, that's true.
You're not saying that they're about other things because they're so tight and they're so controlled. They're only about what they're about. Which sounds ridiculous until you think about how many filmmakers don't make movies like that. I think, and this is a theme that we'll begin to talk about in more depth. I think Lynn Ramsey is, first and foremost, a horror filmmaker.
Yeah.
I think You Were Never Really Here is a horror film.
For sure.
We Need to Talk About Kevin is definitely a horror film.
Mm-hmm.
The least horror is probably Morven Kalla, which is the film that we're going to do next. But even that has some creeping horror. And I think what makes her a great horror filmmaker and what makes a lot of contemporary horror films bad is because there's this belief that in order to get good critical notices or YouTube explained channel updates, horror films need to self-analyze themselves. Like,
yeah,
The Babadook is a film that I have quite serious problems with because The Babadook just ends with an explicit
explanation
of its own thesis. That's a film that sits you
down.
That
film is so much better before The Babadook turns up.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of a masterpiece before The Babadook turns up.
And then it kind of falls apart. Yeah. The film literally ends by going like, hey, did you get it? This has been about grief. We've been grieving here this whole time. And my favorite contemporary horror filmmakers, people like Ari Aster, don't really make films that are specifically self-explanatory whatsoever. I mean, Midsommar is obviously a film about grief, and it's about letting go of certain things, but it's not about it in more explicit ways than that. It just does what it kind of wants to do, and then it leaves the rest.
That happens to the characters. That's the thing that happens to the characters. And it's not like...
And yeah, Ramsey is a horror filmmaker who just kind of gets by on images alone. She's such an imagistic filmmaker. And you're not confusing this as being about anything other than a kid going through the experience of grieving. And more than that, as you said before, a form of grieving that will maybe take him the rest of his life. Maybe he'll get over it tomorrow. Completely unable to tell. We're going to do Letterboxd in a minute.
Yes. We should talk more about Ramsey's inability to make more than four films. Although she's making a Stephen King film at the moment, speaking of horror films.
She is.
And Stephen King.
If you can't hear, Lynn the Pug is...
scrubbling and scrambling.
And possibly puking. That sounded like some puking going on to me. There are many, but not enough, great interviews with Lynn Ramsey.
I'm just thinking about the idea that it's so rare that we welcome something living into our home, leave it and be like, he's throwing up. We'll check later.
You can't imagine any other circumstances under which this would
relatively
happen.
Rare.
If this dog is to spend the allotted 2 weeks with me, it needs to be fine with what's currently happening.
Oh no, I know it's fine. I know it's just something that obviously we are not constantly
No, I'm telling that to myself.
Sure,
I'm justifying why I'm not going down the stairs.
No, it's control puking.
Does that even work?
Control crying? Not really.
Okay. So
it's like a scene from the 70s that people were super into.
Oh, Dan, don't tell me that.
But dogs are different. Dogs, anyway, we don't need to go into it now. Right in.
This was a clean entry for new listeners, and instead it's just been fucking 45 minutes of pug talk. Lynn Ramsey, I think a thing broadly to say, Lynn Ramsey, A, doesn't have much name recognition.
No.
You?
I hadn't heard of her before. I saw You Were Never Really Here at a Sydney Film Festival a few years ago, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And I saw it because... 3 years ago. I saw it because I'd seen like, a lot of good reviews. I hadn't encountered Lynn Ramsey before. I guess I knew they'd made a film out of We Need to Talk About Kevin. Mm-hmm. I hadn't read that book either.
And this...
Which is also interesting given how few female directors are like making major films.
How few Scottish filmmakers are making major films?
That is really notable, I think.
How many filmmakers there are who are that awarded? Everything she's made has won like a shedload of BAFTAs, a shedload of awards at the Cannes Film Festival. They presented You Were Never Really There at... You Were Never Really... They presented You Were Never Really Here at Cannes And it wasn't even finished, and it got a 10-minute standing ovation. Wow. They hadn't mixed the sound properly. They hadn't edited it, all the sequences together. So, you know, she's an extraordinary filmmaker with an extraordinary back catalogue who just isn't talked about very much. And she gives these interviews that are always highly, highly entertaining. I would highly recommend reading. She's given two great ones to The Guardian. And I think this one will begin our discussion of why Lynn Ramsey hasn't made many films. We are sitting under a giant parasol in the garden of Lynn Ramsey's local bar in Tufnell Park, North London, very extremely close to where I grew up. It's raining gently around us, and lunch over, Ramsey, by turns animated, reflective, and intense, is ordering a second large glass of white wine. It's a day off, she quips, and I'm a bit knackered. And anyway, I should be on holiday, and here I am doing press. Now 41, but showing no signs of surrendering her youthful feistiness, Ramsey is entertaining company, whether talking about the art film she loves, by Bergman, Cassavetes. Cassavetes is so obvious.
Yeah.
We'll increasingly see Cassavetes, I think, particularly Husbands. I've never heard her speak specifically about that film, but it's the one that feels most like her work.
That's interesting.
Just because it's got the weird dialogue that like isn't really dialogue. Yeah. It's so heavily image based.
You're really not sure where you are in each sequence. Like, is this going to be an important sequence that goes on forever, or are we going to be somewhere else in 30 seconds?
No arcs really whatsoever to speak to. I mean, Husbands is just a film about a group of men grieving.
Yeah.
Do they get over the grief? Who knows?
Not well.
Not well. Or railing against the bullshitters and backstabbers of the film industry.
Sure.
So one thing we have to talk about is that in 2013...
she would have been disqualified for the series.
Yes. Yes, she would have been. Unless she hadn't made You Were Never Really That's Here true. In that alternate world. She was going to make a script of a... She was going to make a film of a script by a young screenwriter who had written this thing that had been on the blacklist, which is Hollywood's list of the great unproduced
screenplays. Which often turn out to be bad, right? Like, yeah, a lot of when those films are made, they often suck. Yeah.
I don't know what it is.
And they often don't make that much money either. It seems like there's no real correlation between them and quality or success.
No, and now the blacklist has become so hard for anyone to get on that list. So it's become, it was meant to be a way of bringing attention to young, diverse filmmakers.
But it became its own, like, and now hierarchy. Yeah,
exactly. Now it's just an institution unto itself. She was going to make a film of this blacklist screenplay called Jane Got a Gun, which was a feminist western set to star Natalie Portman. And the studio were increasingly insisting that she had to tack a happy ending on it. And she was getting a bad sense of vibes, growing and growing throughout pre-production. And then the day before the first day of shooting, she walked off set. And I think 92% of filmmakers would have made that film and would have hated it. And if we had to do a podcast episode on it, we would have to say, oh, it's kind of a shame that this is a Lynn Ramsey film. She has a spotless record otherwise. And instead, she just walked off.
And extraordinary.
She was sued by the production company. So, yeah, and she countersued them, I think, to try and say that they breached the rules of the contract. But just a filmmaker who doesn't suffer fools gladly. We talked a bit about this Guardian interview that I sent you where she kind of responds to this idea that she's difficult by saying, oh, my crew always love me. Everyone, I get on really well with everyone on set. She seems like a wonderful person to spend time with. But, yeah, I just think it is part of the story that most filmmakers would have made that movie.
Yeah.
And she just flatly refused to make that movie.
Have you seen it? Because it got made, right?
No, I have not.
Okay.
And I remember thinking, that looks like absolute fucking garbage. Yeah. And I think Ramsey is broadly being vindicated by the fact that everyone complains about that film's ending.
Funny.
They're like, what the fuck is this stupid happy ending sat clapped onto the end of this film?
Huh.
And that was precisely what she didn't want to do. I wanted to briefly dovetail on Ramsey's unfinished projects. She was going to be the person, she was selected to make The Lovely Bones. She was the first choice.
Made by Peter Jackson, Peter right?
Jackson, another of my all-time favorite filmmakers. And she read the manuscript before it was even published for The Lovely Bones. Wow. And started working on the screenplay before it had received any acclaim.
Mm.
And she blames the problems that she had on pre-production with that film with the fact that she was turning in drafts that she thought were really good. And the production studio kept saying to her, you need to make it more like the book. You need to make it more like the book. And they were saying that because suddenly the book's blowing up. It's becoming a bestseller. Sure. It's getting critical acclaim. And so she eventually walks off that project
too. That's interesting. I didn't love that book.
You can see how Ramsay Starr would be a perfect fit for it, though, right?
For sure. I can imagine it would have been an amazing Ramsay film.
The fantasy combined with the realism. But it would maybe only have been an extraordinary Ramsay film if she'd been allowed to do what she wanted to do.
Yeah, not, like, use the book as a jumping-off point.
Yeah. Because it's worth saying, and it's something that we'll talk about over the next three episodes, Ratcatcher is the only original film she ever wrote.
Mm.
The others are based on books, but very tangentially related.
It also makes it seem more like the Ratcatcher is memoir-ish, right? Mm. That she's got some source material that she's working with. Because it seems like her films, at least the two that I've seen, seem like what they're interested in doing is circling around references to things, and it makes it much easier when you have the reference there and then can, like, depart from it, as opposed to just trying to create material from scratch.
I'm so excited we need to talk about Kevin.
Hmm.
No one respects that film as the absolute fucking masterpiece that it is.
I look forward to seeing what I think.
I just want to read this directly from her Wikipedia page.
Go for it.
About a film that she was going to make, which sounds like the greatest film anyone's ever even thought about making. Ramsay was planning to direct a modern adaptation of Herman Melville's Moby Dick. She has stated that the film will be set in space and deal with themes of psychology and claustrophobia. Quoting, "So we're creating a whole new world and a new alien. It's a very psychological piece, mainly taking place in the ship, a bit like Dust Boot. So it's quite claustrophobic. It's another monster movie, because the monster's Ahab."
That sounds so good. That sounds really good.
He met Moby Dick in space, directed by Lynn Ramsay.
That sounds so good.
Starring Bradley J. Pitt.
Yeah, that's a dream project.
Pitt could do a really good Ahab. At
this point, definitely.
He just needs to get a little more haggard.
I mean, towards the end of Ad Astra, he's kind of there.
Yeah. Should we do the Letterbox game?
Yeah. I want to see that film.
What do you give Ratcatcher out of 5? Oh, and then I have something to tell you.
Oh, sure. There was a lot of... I would like to see it again.
Pug painting.
Yeah, but probably 4 or 4.5.
Yeah, I think it's a 5-star film.
Yeah,
for me.
I think I would need to see it again, but that makes sense to me.
So, very good friend of the show, Susie Cray, has been...
She's bypassed the email.
She talks directly to me. Oh, she don't need you anymore, Daniel. I hope she doesn't mind. No, I told her that I would talk to you about this. So, Susie has developed a chart.
Mm.
Have you seen of this chart?
I think you talked about on the last. Wait, is this? No. Yeah, I did see that chart. The films that it's like multiple axes, right?
It's a physical chart that Susie has made.
Films I like and like enjoy watching, right? Or quality of film and enjoyment watching or something.
Yeah, so the two axes are
technically
how good the film is and how much Susie enjoyed watching it.
I studied it.
Susie thinks that it would be very helpful to you and your struggle with being able to rate films properly.
I like
properly.
That, actually. I think that's true. I think...
Because did you enjoy Ratcatcher? See, I enjoy it.
Yeah.
I can imagine you not.
That's a good question. I enjoyed some of it.
Mm-hmm.
There were parts I could have done without, but the movie could not have done without. Maybe that's the best way of putting it.
Hmm.
That's kind of what Susie's getting at with that chart, I think. Like, things that I'm not having a good time with, obviously the movie requires.
So technical precision is up, but enjoyment is slightly down.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I just want everyone to be happy.
You wouldn't want a film where everyone's happy, Daniel.
No, I wouldn't.
Maybe you would.
Maybe I would. What's the closest? Can you think of a film with no conflict? I've heard Everybody Wants Some have no conflict. Maybe I should watch that.
I don't like that film so much. Dolomite Is My Name has literally no conflict.
Okay, it's Eddie Murphy film, right?
Yeah, about the making of Dolomite, a blaxploitation hero.
Yeah. Is it good?
It's pretty good.
Okay.
The point of that film is this guy decides that he wants to make movies. and then he makes movies, and everyone has a good time watching the movies. Okay. There's no conflict whatsoever, and it's pretty good, and it's pretty fun.
No hurdles?
No hurdles. I mean, like, he doesn't have a huge amount of money to make these films, but it's never really a problem. It's
not insurmountable.
No, he does fine. He has a good time, and then at the end, everyone watches the film, and they're like, yeah, we liked Dolomite. It's pretty good.
Okay.
3.5 stars to good Dolomite stuff. Is my name. Written by the people who wrote Ed Wood, Tim Burton's Ed Wood.
Oh, yeah.
Which is one of my all-time favorite films. And that has some conflict, but is also genuinely quite sunny. It's like, this guy wants to make movies. Hey, guess what? He made some movies. Some people thought they were pretty bad, but he didn't. And that's the end. I said to Susie, because I knew that Susie was watching Ratcatcher in preparation for this episode. And I said, where would you put Ratcatcher? I said, you will have a wonderful time with Ratcatcher. This was before Susie had watched it. Well, wonderful is a hard word to use for something so bleak. And Susie replied, wonderful was the right word for Snowball, the mouse, going to the moon.
Yeah.
Gentle characters hurt me so much. As always.
Great stuff. Susie knows what's up.
Yeah. Our listeners, as always, are smarter and more intelligent and say things more succinctly than we ever could.
Definitely.
Do you want a high review or a low review? By which I mean a high rating or a low rating.
I'm interested in the low rating, actually. I want to end on a high.
I want to quickly just read this from my friend Geordie Gray. I worked with Geordie for a number of years. Geordie is one of the most essential writers in Australia. Geordie is just one of my favourite people, full stop. Geordie has an incredibly acclaimed Letterboxd. So acclaimed because one of her reviews was included in the crazy Letterboxd Twitter page. Wow. You know that one?
Yeah.
It was screenshotted. I have to read you that review.
Please.
So this is a review of the film Lords of Dogtown.
Oh yeah, I haven't seen it.
Which is
have dancing?
No, Skaters.
Oh, that's
well
close.
Done. Worth a try. Geordie's 4-star review of the 2005 skater film Lords of Dogtown is: if this movie didn't exist, I wouldn't have chronic back pain brought on by a lifetime of letting skaters roar me on their floor mattress.
Oh my gosh, that's pretty funny.
Incredible. Geordie's last 4 ratings I have to read because I agree with actually all of them. These are precisely the ratings I would give to this film. She gave The Social Network 5 stars.
It's a great film.
She gave Belle du Jour, the Louis Buñuel film. You haven't seen it?
No.
Really good. 4.5 stars. She gave The Fucking Souvenir, goddamn fucking bad piece film. Of shit, The Souvenir, 1 star.
Yeah.
I think that's possibly in the running for one of the worst films ever made.
I did not like that film.
Awful. So fucking boring.
Yeah.
Just criminal for a film to be that boring. Geordie's review is big boring wank fest. Poo bum jobby jobby. Tilda Swinton's hair looked nice though.
Oh yeah, Tilda Swinton's good in that actually.
I don't know if she is.
She's Tilda Swinton.
She's always pretty good.
I enjoyed watching her on screen, but I didn't enjoy that film.
And the 4th film that Geordie rated is Ponyo. 4.5
great
stars.
Film. One of the
I Must Taste the Ramen Egg is her review.
Oh yeah, one of the second tier Ghibli films, but and that being said, extraordinary. Yeah.
Kiki's Delivery Service has got to be the best. I think I say that every time
I love
we talk
My
Ghibli.
Neighbor Totoro a lot. There's a lot of good stuff in Totoro. Kiki's Delivery Service is up. Kiki's Delivery Service is basically a film with no conflict. I guess she has to.
She loses her magic fucking
powers.
Daniel.
That's true.
What the hell?
Sorry, I forgot about that bit. And then she gets them back.
It's the deep
spoiler alert
moving.
For Kiki's Delivery Service.
Yeah.
If you expected it to end with her never getting her powers back.
Imagine, like, snapping your phone over the back of your leg because you listened to the Ratcatcher episode of the Brad Pitt cast and you had Kiki's Delivery Service ruined for you. Geordie's 4.5 star review of Ratcatcher. Better than Mouse Hunt, but not as good as Stuart Little.
That's pretty good. I have seen all those films. And
Mouse Hunt,
I remember
Stuart
Mouse
Little.
Hunt deeply unsettling me as a child.
Scary
Too
film.
Scary for me as a kid.
Christopher Walken eats rat poo at one point.
I don't remember that. I've obviously repressed that. Is Nathan Lane in Mouse Hunt?
Yes, he is. Nathan Lane and that English comedian whose name I can't remember. How would you rank Ratcatcher, Stuart Little, and Mouse Hunt?
I think in that order. But I didn't enjoy Stuart Little much. No. I think I have this set of films that I went to Europe with my parents when I was like 12, and I think films I would watch, I had like watched on the plane, because I think it was an era when you couldn't start a film when you wanted to, you just had to tune into the channel.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I saw GoldenEye, no, not GoldenEye, The World Is Not Enough,
mm-hmm.
like in 7 different chunks from different yeah. like kind of a fractal World Is Not Enough experience. And I also watched Stuart Little a few times, because you like to get to Europe is like 20 hours or whatever, and coming back, and then a bunch of flights within Europe.
So you just watched
films, yeah, Stuart Little and The World Is Not Enough. There must have been others, but I can't recall them off the top of my head.
I want to read you just out of anger.
Mm.
This is the top review of Ratcatcher.
Okay.
And this is an indictment on Letterboxd.
Sure.
Ratcatcher, a beautiful lyrical film made from the heart.
For sure.
Lynn Ramsey could bonk me on the head with a film camera and say, "Hey, look, I'm filming here in it." And I would reply, "My apologies. Please feel free to bonk me again if that helps you in any way, shape, or form." That's the top review.
It's not.
Of the site that's being heralded as the future of film
critics. Substanceless.
Anyway. Okay, so a low review you want.
Mm.
What is it? Half a star? I mean, we're going to film.
Yeah, that's what I'm kind of interested. You can only think it's too grim, right? Like, it's too bleak and boring has to be the anti-Ratcatcher stance.
This one's a bit more confusing than that. Top okay. 4 films of this user are Whiplash. I hate that film.
Sure.
Django Unchained. Pretty good. Have you seen Django?
Yeah.
I like it.
It's fine.
Leo is extremely good.
Yeah, he's great. Leo's great in it. And also,
Samuel L. Jackson.
No. Samuel L. Jackson is good. What's his name?
Christoph Waltz.
No, the protagonist. Django. Who plays Django?
Jamie Foxx.
Jamie Foxx is great in that film, I think.
Yeah.
He's fun.
Yeah, he's okay. Sometimes Jamie Foxx kind of...
I think he is wildly inconsistent.
Yeah, I think he's best in Horrible Bosses.
I have not seen that.
I like Horrible Bosses.
Okay, I'll check it out. The last Jason Bateman recommendation you gave me was pretty good.
Game Night, yeah. You enjoyed it. I think Horrible Bosses is pretty good. It's just funny. It's just a bunch of funny people.
I love jokes.
You do love jokes. I was talking to one of your tutoring students the other day.
Oh boy.
One of the students who attended the tutorials that you do.
Uh-huh.
And I asked, I was like... Does Dan do jokes in tutorials?
What did they say?
The student.
I genuinely have no idea what the answer will be.
The student said, Dan is kind of wryly funny.
That's interesting.
That's not the same thing as doing jokes.
No, I don't have a set. I don't have a type 5.
Sometimes you walk into a tutor room and they absolutely do have a set. I tell you that for sure. This person's other two top 4 films, Jaws. It's okay. You like Jaws.
Solid film, 7 out of 10.
And Jojo Rabbit, directed by
Taika. Not seen it, but I'm sure I would hate it. Even though I like, generally like Taika Waititi.
This is a 0.5-star review of Ratcatcher. Lovely film, Lynn, but any film that dangles animals from string gets a poor rating from me.
That is.
But wait, it gets crazier. The last line, it's just a movie. Oh, I understand. It's just a movie. You shouldn't do that to animals.
I think so.
Not, because I thought it's just a movie is what you would say to someone who makes an overly grand claim about what's going on in the film Ratcatcher, which this user appears to do.
Does this person know what it is sanctioned to do to mice in our society?
Yes.
They are the worst treated animals. They gotta be, right?
I have... So when
in terms of what is socially acceptable across all everywhere.
When I was a child, I heard this story about a friend of a friend whose older brother... worked in an animal testing facility.
Okay. Do I want to hear this or not?
I mean, it's kind of...
You can say it.
Yeah, nobody wants to hear this.
Sure, but sometimes we have to.
He was tasked with cutting the heads off mice with just a big pair of scissors. He would just line them up and chop their heads off.
It's a serial killer origin story.
And it was really scary and really upsetting for me to hear this. And then a couple of years ago, I was at a party... And I talked to this guy who was like, yeah, I had to recently do a placement at an animal testing facility. I was in charge of cutting the heads off mice with a giant pair of scissors. So conditions have not changed in the two and a half decades since I first heard this horrible story that fucked me up. This movie unintentionally made me cry at dead mice and laugh at a kid drowning, and I'm fucking Scottish too. Is this person
true? Mice in this film, apart from mice that are already dead. No, I don't see a mice die.
It goes to the mouse. It goes to the
yeah, and then there's the mice early on near the mousetrap, but they don't actually get caught by the mousetrap. And then there's like rat corpses, but they're probably fake.
So this is a kind of substantive review. Top four films. Celine and Julie Go Boating by Jack Rivette. People adore that
film. People do love that film. I have not seen it.
It's 3 hours and 13 minutes long.
Too long for Dan.
I think possibly too long for me. Yeah. I think I will maybe never see that film.
I did watch the Snyder Cut, though.
Did you watch the whole thing?
Yeah, I watched the whole thing. Over several days.
What do you give it?
I don't even know.
I think it's 3.5 stars.
Sure, three stars. I mean, I watched it all. There's other films I haven't watched all of.
The epilogue is...
baffling. Wild. What are we doing, Zach?
The
dream sequence and then joke. Martian Manhunter.
Yeah, Martian Manhunter. Yeah, fucking Jared Leto being a mess. A total mess.
Yeah, not good.
Oh, awful. This person's other top four films. Gremlins 2, The New Batch.
I've only seen Gremlins 1. I would love to see Gremlins
2. Gremlins 2 is a masterpiece.
Yeah, I got to see that film. I love Gremlins 1.
Yeah, I would really highly recommend it. Okay. It's even better. It's better in every imaginable way.
And Gremlins is a good film, right?
Gremlins is great. I adore Gremlins.
One of the best Christmas films, I think.
Yes, because there's the whole sequence about fucking the girl's dad dying.
Oh, that's
because
right.
He was a Father Christmas who got stuck in the chimney.
Yeah, that was a bonkers film.
Dead of Night. I've never heard of this film. It's a horror film directed by the person who made A Fish Called Wanda.
Oh.
Very strange. And this person's fourth favourite film is Gregory's Girl, directed by Bill Forsyth. People love Forsyth, but I haven't seen anything by him. This person's review.
Lynn the pug is acting up again.
Yeah. There had been quite a lot of silence. I thought maybe we would be okay. Terminally overrated art film by numbers. Name one thing that this film does that's new or different or is not derivative.
That's crazy.
I can name
a dozen.
A lot of things that this does. What is this person looking for?
Yeah.
The use of music is completely unlike anything you've seen in a film of this kind. The sequence where fucking Lollipop starts playing and there's the drop of strawberry jam on the ice cream.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Which is a jump cut designed to imply that someone's been stabbed with a knife. What other film has something like that?
Yeah.
The elliptical storytelling style. Anyway, listen to this podcast. Redacted name of Letterboxd user. It's nicely derivative, yes, but it's also achingly boring, as if there's a big stew of British art film cliché that's been overcooked and forced down our throats.
It just didn't feel like anything else to me.
No, I couldn't compare it to anything at all. I have no idea how this has a good reputation at all. Baffling. You know.
Let's do some good... I want some good reviews.
Oh, this person is giving it 5 stars.
Oh.
The top four films are John Cassavetes' Husbands.
Is that right?
A Woman Under the Influence, directed by John Cassavetes. Mikey and Nikki, directed by Elaine May.
Yeah.
And Rosemary's...
starring John Cassavetes.
And Rosemary's Baby.
Also starring John Cassavetes.
Yeah. Wow.
What do they have to say about it?
They didn't say anything.
Okay.
Because they were kind of on the fly. They had to go and pick up a puck.
Sure. Priorities.
The only words I understand are the swears, and there's no subtitles provided on my DVD, but this is for sure one of my all-time favorites.
I like that. I'm on board with that.
Had to turn the subs on because Scottish people are so hard to understand.
Imagine if you had a pug breathing down your neck the whole time as you were watching.
Exactly. In a bit, Snowball, this person says. Let me just find...
I mean, the mouse stands out so much.
It really does.
And not, but somehow it doesn't overwhelm the film, but it's like, you can't come away from this film not being stunned by Snowball.
Snowball the mouse. Everyone, just like so many people have just said, Lynn Ramsey! !
But you know why? Because she's got a really distinct style that is manifested in this film.
Yes. Seems like a really good person to do a podcast miniseries on. I'm sorry, Dan, it's late. Let me give
you... No, that's all right. One more. One more 5-star. I'm fading a little.
This person says, I enjoyed this more than any of the other Lynn Ramsey films that I've seen. And then I look at their top four films and We Need to Talk About Kevin as one of their top
inconsistent.
Four films.
So inconsistent. And Ratcatcher isn't.
No.
Baffling.
Let me give you a best one. Okay, here we go. Sam McMahon, top four films. Pretty interesting. Good Time, directed by the Safdies.
I like that film. I've seen that film twice.
Huh. Very rare for you.
I don't think it's as good as Uncut Gems.
Huh.
It's neater, and Pattinson is unbelievable. But it's that's a very stressful film.
It's deeply... I like
it Uncut Gems better. It might upset you too
much. I like Uncut Gems because Uncut Gems has more humanity.
It's funnier too.
Yeah, good Time.
It does a little humorless. It also has the... Yeah, we don't need to get into it.
The disability. All of that kind of stuff. But it's more... I think it's more... It's really satisfied with itself.
Yeah.
And in Uncut Gems, because it cares so much about the character, that self-satisfaction is not as present.
Yeah, they love Howie so much.
They really do. And they love the Julia Fox character so much. Yeah, she's unbelievable. That romance is really played for real.
What a film. I should watch that again.
It's so good.
I've seen that twice too, actually.
Oh, it's so good. Star Wars, The Last Jedi.
You know, speaking of Star Wars and the Safdies...
Benny is going to be in the Obi-Wan Kenobi series. The series.
Oh, okay. I didn't
please, Daniel. It's a mini series.
Coming to Disney Plus.
Coming to Disney Plus.
Of course it is. Everything else.
Disney Plus. Whoa, fucking
more
hell.
Like, yeah.
More like gone.
It doesn't matter.
More like Disney Zero.
Minus, I was going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure I was going to say, and I'm like, someone else has definitely said that.
You know, sometimes you can be derivative. Just don't listen to that last guy.
That's what the creators of all the shows on Disney Plus are thinking.
Hey-o! Fucking take that, Disney. Oh no, we're never going to get the Marvel money.
Yeah.
Could we pivot if we really
want? WandaCast? To the Marvel cast?
The WandaCast. Do a minute-by-minute robot. Fucking, can you
how
imagine?
How many episodes is that?
I'd rather fucking sand my face off with glass. Handfuls of broken glass. The Shining. Great
film.
5-star film.
That's a film I saw for the first time in a cinema and was really happy that I did.
Did you see it for the first time in a cinema? Good. Yeah. Unbelievable film.
You know what I did the other day? I was lying in my bed and I had been teaching and I was like so tired and I was like, I can't do anything. And I lifted up my phone and I was like, what is on Netflix? And I watched the first 10 minutes of A Full Metal Jacket.
Did you have a good time?
I've seen that film.
Hmm.
Crazy.
I don't know if I like Full Metal Jacket.
It's so... I definitely have a good time, if that's the graph we're operating with. It's so grating.
Yeah, it does so many different
Kubrick
things.
Kubrick fucking hates his audience sometimes, I think.
He does, which is why The Shining is good, because The Shining needs to feel like an alien artifact that wants to kill you. And sometimes his films don't quite work that way.
Yeah.
Eyes Wide Shut is a masterpiece. You got to see.
I really want to see that. See that one. I've yet to see that, but desperately want to.
This person's fourth favourite film, Claire Denis's Beau Travail.
I should watch that. I should watch more Claire Denis.
There's a lot on Criterion Channel. Watch Beau Travail first. You have an extraordinary time with it.
Is that about the French Foreign Legion?
It kind of. And it's based on a Herman Melville short story. The guy who wrote Moby Dick.
Yes.
Billy Budd.
I think I read that.
Huh. It's based on that.
I taught it a while ago, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Like years ago. One of the first ever American literature class I taught in like 2015.
Do you have jokes back then?
No, I was too scared.
More jokes these days. The joke quotient has gone up.
Harder to joke over Zoom, though, I tell you.
Oh, is it really?
Basically impossible.
That sounds like the start of a bit right there.
Let me tell you.
Oh, Lynn, please.
We got, yeah.
This person's review. To be a rat attached to a balloon and fucked off to the moon.
Wonderful. I think it was a mouse, but that's fine.
Wait, the movie's called Ratcatcher, Dan. It's not a mouse. Oh, yeah, no, it is.
There are rats in it. Who knows?
Listen, I wish you had seen the disdain in Dan's eyes when he looked me square in the face and said, Snowball's a mouse.
Sorry, I'm so sorry. I'm quite tired.
No, it was beautiful.
No disdain for Joseph, but on the record, zero.
You were really like, shut the fuck up. Next week... Next time,
Morven Keller, which I don't know anything about apart from the fact that it's Scottish.
You do know nothing about it?
I know nothing about it.
Probably keep it that way.
Okay.
It has a real nice hook. Something happens very early that it would be better if you didn't know about, so keep it that way. Don't find out. Lynn Ramsey. Fucking Lynn Ramsey.
I'm excited to be doing, to be continuing on with the Ramsey cast.
And then we need to talk about Kevin. And then we end with You Were Never Really Here.
Hit after hit. There's the lesson from Four or Fewer is don't make many things and make them all really good.
Yes.
That's...
Yeah. Say no. Walk off the set.
Yeah.
And get sued. And but be happy. And have a good record left behind.
Mm.
Speak to you next time. Let's all find out together where Lynn the Pug will be.
Yeah, the narrative, the story of Lynn, the saga of Lynn. You'll be kept up to date.
Of course.
The BradPittCast@gmail.com is still our email address.
Send us an email.
At BradPittCast on Twitter. Please be in touch. Tell us what you think about this series. Tell us if there's another director who has made four films or fewer that you think we should cover.
Yes, give us a list of directors who have made four films or fewer. Alex Garland, I keep thinking about Alex Garland.
Ex Machina, yeah.
And Devs, he has that TV series Devs, which is really good.
Oh, really? Okay. I
love Devs.
Sure. That's a TV series. We can do whatever we want.
We can do whatever the fuck we
want. Sending a mouse to the moon.
Exactly.
See you next time.
See you next time.